You ever promised yourself 10 minutes on social media, but 3 hours later and you're still scrolling? Said you would just watch one episode of something on Netflix, but 5 hours later and you're still glued to the screen? Declared victoriously, no dessert for me tonight, but then 30 minutes later and you're pounding cake off other people's plates? Or have you ever busted one too many nuts over big boobies on the internet? Hold on, who wrote this script? Well, stupid of me to ask these questions, really, because the answer is clearly yes. But not to worry, this doesn't mean your brain is broken. Why? Well, because your brain is designed to eat berries in a cave, but now it's being pulled left, right, up, down by all the juicy, shiny, jiggly temptations of the modern world. In other words, your brain is ancient, the world is modern. So, right off the bat, why does resisting your temptations matter? Well, for two reasons, one of which I really wish wasn't true. First of all, every time you give in to your temptations, you're training your brain to do so again. So if you resist now, you reclaim control of your life. And finally, temptation isn't just one moment, it shapes your entire future. What you do today decides who you become tomorrow. But if you haven't got a lot of time, then here is the main takeaway I want you to have from this video. Temptation isn't evil, it's biology. Your brain evolved in an environment of scarcity, whereby things weren't guaranteed tomorrow. Hence, the now part of your brain that gets you to act impulsively convinces you, act on this opportunity now, seize it while you have the chance, because tomorrow it might not be here. That's why it's addicted to maybe, constantly getting you to chase desires instead of fully satisfying you, because if you don't chase, you don't survive. The only problem is, nowadays we don't live in scarcity. Things are now guaranteed. But good news, there is a later part of your brain that doesn't just prioritise the now, it prioritises long-term growth and regulates the now part of your brain. Here's how to wake it up. 1. Mentally multiply your actions. Don't just picture the image of a one-time slip, picture 30. Why? Well, think about why most people who smoke only buy one packet of cigarettes at a time. It's because it's much easier to betray your moral compass when you just consider giving in to a temptation once. So, picture what giving in to this temptation every single day for the next 90 days would really bring to your life. Imagine it in gruesome detail and make sure that you feel it so that you scare yourself. Then, when the urges arise, let them rain on you. Recognize the urge. Accept it. Judgment-free. Investigate what's going on in your body when it arises and then note those sensations with words. I feel a tightness in my chest or a buzzing in my stomach. Sit in between the thought of giving into the temptation and the action of actually doing it. And you'll notice that your urges rise and peak like waves and then they crash. Your only job is to ride them to shore. But if you'd like a bit more of a deeper explanation, then here's exactly what we're going to cover within the rest of the video. If that sounds like enough, by the way, feel free to click off. First of all, we're going to define our terms, get really clear on what we mean by impulsivity, temptation, addiction, and willpower. Then we're going to cover the 5 reasons why temptation hijacks our brain. Yes, there are 5 reasons I have found. Then we're going to get straight into how to resist temptation, using those 5 reasons, then highlighting the solutions, then we will finalise on an upbeat, optimistic note by covering the upsides of impulsivity. I have spent the last month researching this video, hence it is so long. Nevertheless, let's get straight into point number 1. Let's get clear on our terms. Okay, now we're warmed up. Peace, Lily, what are you saying? My temptation, which I've been gladly indulging in recently, has been yerba mate. Argentinians, where you at? Okay, first of all, before we do anything else in this video, we need to define our terms so that we are crystal clear on exactly what we're referring to in the practical sections we're going to cover later. I want you to know exactly what we mean when we're using 4 key terms related to the topic of temptation. First of all, let's define impulsivity. Simply put, impulsivity is your brain prioritizing now. And it prioritizes now in order to feel good now, but it doesn't realize that that is going to drain energy later. Some examples of impulsive activities could be the common culprits of our bad habits, you know, binge eating on junk food, scrolling, PMO, whatever comes to mind. The opposite of impulsivity, however, is another term that we throw around in our society a lot, willpower. Simply put, willpower is your brain prioritizing later. See how it's the opposite of impulsivity. To go one step further, willpower is your brain using a different response known as the pause and plan response. It's your prefrontal cortex regulating the other parts of your brain that just want to act now. An analogy to think about when it comes to willpower is the brake that your brain uses to slow down a very powerful engine. Impulsivity. And the key is you don't want to remove the engine, you just need to learn how to steer the engine, essentially. Now, those two are highlighted. What arises within the tug of war between these two things, impulsivity and willpower, is temptation. That's all temptation is. This tug of war between your brain wanting to act now and your brain wanting to prioritize later. When I say your brain, what I'm saying is there's a part of your brain that wants to act now, and there's a part of your brain that wants to prioritize later. Later, prefrontal cortex. Now, the older survival parts of your brain, to put it simply. When you experience the urge to give in to a temptation, your brain is asking, do I want short-term comfort or do I want to prioritize long-term meaning? And while it's making that decision, that's when you feel the discomfort of the urge. Last thing we need to define is addiction. All addiction is impulsivity on a loop. Specifically through the stages of cue, craving, action or response, relief, and then repeat. Addiction takes impulsivity one step further, and it creates an identity where you believe you no longer choose this action. This action chooses you. And no matter how much effort you put in to try and break this habitual loop, it feels impossible. That's what addiction is. But just before we move on, the key thing to note when it comes to impulsivity and addiction is not all impulsive behavior leads to addiction, but impulsive behavior can allow the Impulsive behavior can lay the foundations in the brain for addiction to form. Okay? So don't worry about remembering all of these terms and writing down the definitions, although if you want to do that, that's fine. I just wanted to get clear. So now we're moving on into the section 2 and section 3. When we use these terms, you know exactly what we're referring to. All right, let's get into the juicy stuff. Point number 2. Now that we understand those definitions, and we understand what temptation is, why do we give in to it? There are 5 reasons as to why we give in to temptation, and all I want you to do as we go through this section and cover each one on the board is pay attention to which one speaks most to you right now. You don't have to remember all of the information. And then when we go into point number 3, simply pay attention to that section's solution the most, because it will apply the most to you. Let's go. First reason. The first reason as to why we succumb to temptation is because our brain seeks the chase, not the hit. And the bottom line of this section is our brains are addicted to maybe. Now, this idea of maybe highlights a really interesting thing about the brain, which is it loves to anticipate things. You know, when you think about the desires and the temptations that you succumb to most, just have a little think about that moment in which you feel the urge and the impulse of the temptation arise. Okay, you think about doing this thing. Maybe you're working and you suddenly think about going downstairs and opening the fridge and eating something, or you think about watching pornography on the internet. In that space between your brain having the idea of doing this action and you actually doing it, there is a window of anticipation where your brain thinks, oh, we're going to get a reward, we're going to get a big payoff. Why does it do this? And what is responsible for the brain doing this? Well, it's a molecule you've heard before and it gets thrown around everywhere on the internet nowadays. It's the molecule of dopamine. Dopamine is the molecule of desire and anticipation. It is what motivates you to act for a potential future reward. dopamine is obsessed with more, which is great to an extent, because if we didn't have dopamine regulating our behaviors as human beings, then I wouldn't be here, neither would you, neither would anyone else. Our ancestors probably wouldn't have made it out of Africa. Why? Well, because they would have just thought, well, you know, life's all right, you know. What's up, Rhino? Yeah, boys, yeah. They would have just said, do you know what, life's fine here. Let's not venture out and seek pastures new and curate all of these desires for new and more and better things. In other words, desire helps us survive, and it is the reason why we are all alive. Now, in order to explain why that would be the case, just take a moment to think about the difference in life now and the difference in life back then for our ancestors thousands of years ago. Back then, okay, when it was caveman times, or even when our ancestors were hunter-gatherers about 10,000 years ago or so, everything was uncertain. Nothing was guaranteed. The desires that they had in front of them could be here tomorrow, could be here today, gone tomorrow. To illustrate this, if you're a caveman and you walk along and you see a bush full of berries, or you see a honeycomb, whatever, your reasoning would be, well, life's pretty scary most of the time. I have no idea if I'm going to be here tomorrow, and I have no idea whether I'm going to have a reward in front of me like this tomorrow. So let's indulge now so I can increase my chances of survival and not pass up this juicy reward. Things were scarce back then. The problem nowadays is we still think like this. Our brain is still wired to act now because it thinks that resources are scarce. But resources aren't scarce. Look around you. You probably have a fridge full of food, maybe. Or if not, you could order anything you wanted off the internet. There's a multitude of people you could go and have sex with. And just things aren't in short supply anymore. Which highlights a term that anthropologists use in order to describe this, modern mismatch. And all this highlights is how we have an ancient brain living in a modern world, which explains why throughout the day we experience so many micro desires and we're pulled left, right, up, down by our temptations. But before we move on here, it might be worth mentioning, or it's definitely worth mentioning, that desire isn't a bad thing. If you didn't have desire, which is, what's the term for people who don't want things? It's not apathy, is it? I can't remember. I'll figure it out in a second. Not having desire is disastrous because you wouldn't want to do anything and you wouldn't survive because you would think, oh, you know, I can't be bothered to eat. Oh, I can't be bothered to do that. No, that is very bad for you. So desiring things isn't a bad thing. It's not the worst thing in the world to want to flirt with your co-worker, buy those shoes or eat that cake. The only problem is if you continue to engage in the modern desires that we are all exposed to, then you're forming the pathway in the brain for addiction, as we covered. Impulsivity, engaging in things now, lays the foundations in the brain for addiction to form. And when that addiction forms, that behavioural loop, dopamine is now governing your behaviour. Remember what we said about dopamine. It is the molecule of more. So you're always going to crave more, and no matter how many times you give in to this temptation, you are never going to be satisfied. That is when the problem arises, when you give in to something again and again and again. That was a lot of things we mentioned. What did I want to mention now? Oh, yes. But the good news here, in the upside for you, is, as I just rubbed him off, evolutionarily speaking, our brain didn't just stop when it evolved the part of itself that wants to engage in things now. No, it went a little bit further and evolved a counterpart. You see, it just like when you're driving a car, you need an accelerator and a brake, so too your brain needs an accelerator, which is go, 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 pursue this thing, engage in this temptation, give in to desire, and it also needs a part of itself that can say, whoa, hold on a second here. Let's not be so hasty. In other words, your brain formed the front part, which we mentioned earlier, the prefrontal cortex, in order to regulate the part of itself that wants to engage in now. In other words, our brains discovered that the future exists. Was there anything else I wanted to mention here? Oh yeah. So now versus later. Before we move on, and seeing as we mentioned the molecule dopamine, a great way to think about dopamine is it's like a salesman without a conscience. It just wants to sell you stuff, but it doesn't really matter if that stuff is good for you long term or not. So what we need to do now is we need to become really familiar with the sales pitch of that salesman. Here are the five common whispers that the salesman of dopamine gives you. The first sales pitch is moral licensing. This is where you convince yourself, you know, I've been good, so I deserve this. You know what? I helped a woman cross the road today, so I deserve 3 hours of scrolling. Number two is progress reward. This is where you hear the sound of, you know what? I've done some, so I can slack now. I've been to the gym every day this week, so I deserve not going for 4 days. The third one is halo mixing. This sounds like, I bought this chocolate for charity, so I can have some too, right? This is where you mix a virtuous action with an unvirtuous one so as to cancel them both out. The fourth sales pitch is optimism credit. This is where you say, I'll make up for it tomorrow. You know, I've distracted myself today, but I'll make up for it next week by doing even more hard work. You're too optimistic over your efforts in the future, and you're not realizing that how you're acting today will influence the choices you make tomorrow. The final sales pitch is, what the hell effect? You know, screw it, let's dig a hole. I've already scrolled for an hour, might as well spend the rest of the afternoon scrolling, or I've already relapsed once, let me relapse again. We all fall victim to these, by the way, so if you're feeling as if this is calling you out, I'm also feeling the same. Righty-ho, that is the first reason as to why we give in to temptation. We are obsessed with the chase, not the hit, so we are always seeking more, because desiring things has aided our survival thus far, but the problem is we live in a world where things aren't scarce, which is why we succumb to temptation so much. Okay, the second reason why we succumb to temptation is neuroadaptation. Now, I know that sounds like a big, scary psychological word. Don't worry, it's actually very simple. All it means is your brain becomes less sensitive to something the more it's exposed to it. Why? Well, it does this so that it can pay more attention to things that really matter. To give a quick example here, let's imagine you walk into a new restaurant for the first time. What usually happens? Well, you've never been there before, so your brain is sensitive to everything that's going on. It's sensitive to the smells coming from the kitchen, from the food, from other people's plates, to the conversations going on, the colours and the shapes and sizes of everything in the restaurant. But after you've been to that same restaurant 7 times, when you walk in, your brain starts to ignore certain things, so it can pay attention to other things that matter, such as the conversation you're having with the person across the table from you, or what to order from the menu you have in your hands. The key mechanism that is going on here, which highlights the danger of this very natural thing the brain does, is summarized in one sentence. Pleasure down means trespasses into your temptations are easier. Why? 4 steps of this cycle. Your brain is exposed to something. Then the dopamine receptors in your brain downregulate, which means that they become less sensitive. It's not necessarily that your dopamine levels decrease. It just means that your receptors aren't picking up the dopamine that is in the brain because they've been used so much. then the pleasure you experience from everyday life and these desires decreases, meaning that your brain then needs to jump above that dopamine deficit it's in with more stimulation. So it tries to expose itself to things which have the potential of being more pleasurable, and then the cycle starts again and you're in a dopamine hole, as we say. I tried to illustrate it here with the first time you're exposed to something like pornography, or the temptation that you're dealing with is very stimulating and your brain is very sensitive to it. Do it every day for God knows how long in some of our cases, and your brain needs more stimulation upon exposure to this temptation. Now let's move on here by zooming out to really consider the bigger picture of all of this. In order to zoom out and consider the bigger picture here, let me briefly introduce you to Neil Garrett, a PhD researcher at the Door Lab, Princeton Institute for Neuroscience. And after chewing on this topic of neuroadaptation, he thought of an interesting thesis to research. He thought, you know, if our brains adapt to sights, sounds, and smells in our environment, what about our emotions? In other words, he asked himself, if you continue to do something that you feel bad towards again and again and again, would your emotional response gradually decrease over time? The bottom line is yes. Here's how he studied it. Him and his researchers got participants to lay down in a fMRI scanner, which allowed them to have a look at the brain activity going on inside the participants, specifically within the brain region, the amygdala, which is responsible for emotional responses predominantly aimed towards fear and threat. Now, what the participants did in the fMRI scanner is they used a keyboard to send messages to someone else who was outside the scanner. They were told that both computers were connected, so any messages they sent to this person outside would be received instantly. But here's the catch. Throughout the experiment, the participants were given multiple opportunities to lie in their messages to this person outside the scanner in order to earn more money. The more you lied, the more money you got, was the incentive. The results? Well, at first, as you would expect, when they began to lie, there was a lot of activity in the participants' amygdala. But over time, as they practiced dishonesty more and more and sent more false messages to this person outside the scanner, their brain activity and emotional spikes gradually decreased. But it didn't just stop there. Soon, the door flew wide open, and there was little to no brain activity in this part of the brain, the amygdala, as the participants continued to be dishonest. So, those are the results, and that is the bigger picture. Zooming back into the topic of today, and now let's cover how this applies to your life. Well, I've got some good and I've got some bad news. The good news is what this means is when you're about to indulge in a temptation you don't want to, your emotions serve the purpose of regulating your behaviour. In other words, the more you have an emotional spike in face of the possibility of you indulging in a temptation you don't want to, then the bigger the likelihood that you won't do it, because your emotions are shouting at you saying, don't do this. To give you a quick example, think about the last time you relapsed into something, a bad habit that you said once upon a time you didn't want to do anymore. What did you feel after? You likely felt very guilty. Why? Because your emotions were trying to tell you, hey, don't do this thing anymore. We're going to make you feel bad when you do it because we don't want you to do it. So listen to us. But of course, we try to numb ourselves from that guilt because it's uncomfortable. That's the good news. Your emotions are in place to regulate your behaviour. The bad news is, the more you engage in a temptation that you feel bad towards, the more quiet your emotions are going to be. In other words, small trespasses over time feel less bad, which means bigger slips into this temptation become much easier. Because your emotions aren't regulating your behaviour, because you've become so desensitised to doing this thing. Now look, it's not all doom and gloom, because in point number three, we're going to reverse engineer this whole process. Don't worry. We're going to tackle this. Anything else I wanted to mention? No. Nah. Right. Don't worry. We're going to reverse engineer this. Now moving on to the third reason as to why we give in to temptations. The third reason we give in to temptation is due to emotional vulnerability and conditioning. But first of all, let's begin with this idea of conditioning. What we mean by this is you engage in temptation because you either want to turn on pleasant emotions or turn off unpleasant ones. This is known as relief learning or operant conditioning in psychology, and the loop is very simple. You experience a negative emotion, boredom, stress, anger, grief, sadness, loneliness. Then you want quick relief from that unpleasant sensation, so you engage in a temptation. You scroll, for example, you light up a cigarette, you eat junk food, or do whatever comes to mind. Then what happens? Well, you experience relief from that unpleasant emotion, so your brain tags that activity that you did as working. Then it creates automatic impulses so that you can even more quickly engage in that activity whenever you experience that unpleasant state again. Which explains how if you've engaged in a certain habit for a really long period of time. Let's say you always scroll whenever you feel bored, but one day you wake up and you think, you know what, I don't want to have this habit anymore, so I want to respond to boredom differently. And instead, when you feel bored, you try and sit there and resist the urge to scroll. What happens? Your brain says, whoa, this isn't the procedure. When we feel bored, we scroll. So it increases your cravings, and they go haywire. But if you wait long enough, it will gradually decrease, which is a tool we're going to cover later, which is one of the most important ones in this video. But anyway, that explains why urges increase when you resist. Now, before we move on here, you might be thinking, Lewis, okay, I've got a problem with scrolling at the moment, Lewis. So I've been scrolling for 3-5 hours every single day for the last 5 years of my life in response to experiencing these unpleasant emotions. But the thing is, Lewis, now I am experiencing the long-term negative effects of doing this habit, which is I've now had brain fog for the last 2 weeks. My relationships are suffering and my motivation and zest and energy for life has just plummeted. Why doesn't my brain, after experiencing these long-term negative consequences, then take those consequences and say, ah, right, I now see the consequences of my actions. Let's stop scrolling whenever we feel bored. Let's do something else. Well, it's because your brain only remembers the relief. It doesn't remember the long-term costs. In other words, when you start to experience the long-term negative effects of doing something, your brain looks at all of those effects and says, where have these come from? Do you know what? I have no idea. Anyway, let's do that thing that provides us with relief. It doesn't attribute the long-term consequences with the action it did ages ago. It looks at that middle gap between those two things and thinks, well, where's the attribution? I have no idea how these two things are related. I really hate to do this, to give this as an analogy, but you have to treat this part of your brain as if it's a small puppy. You know, if you're trying to train a puppy into better behavior, then you have to give direct consequences to its actions in the moment. Whereas if it wees on the carpet and then, I don't know, you punish it in some way 3 weeks later, the puppy's going to be like, hold on, what's this? What's this punishment for? It's not going to understand that action, consequence. It's going to think action, random consequence. How are these two things related? Yes. Two more things I wanted to mention here before we move on. If your life isn't going well and you're experiencing a lot of stress, arguments, exhaustion, whatever else, your willpower is going to sag. Remember, your willpower is your ability to prioritize later rather than just now. Wanted to mention that, which highlights the emotional vulnerability. You know, whenever I'm tired or stressed, that is when my bad habits arise and say, forgotten about us, choose us now, because it provides me with relief. This highlights one step further the what the hell effect, which is hilarious. I find this hilarious because I just put it on the board and realised how funny it is. You've succumbed to a temptation, you feel guilty. That guilt is an unpleasant emotion, so you want relief. Then you engage in that temptation even more. You feel guiltier. You want relief. You feel guiltier. You feel relief. How do we get out of that cycle here? Well, we'll cover that later. Now, the last thing I wanted to mention here is this largely arises due to something I learned in research in this video called self-discrepancy theory. In 1987, there was a psychologist called Tori Higgins who suggested that most of the time in our ideas of ourselves, there is a gap between who we are right now and who we think we should be. And when we're in that gap, we feel unpleasant emotions that we want to numb ourselves from. Again, I'm teasing you a lot just to lay ourselves up for later, but we're going to cover how to close that gap so that we can stop feeling unpleasant and wanting to numb ourselves from that sensation all of the time. Okay, let's fire off the last two reasons as to why we succumb to temptation. Second to last. Oh, by the way, if you have ADHD or bipolar, you are much more likely to experience impulsive behaviours. Just wanted to mention that. Second to last reason. The second to last reason we succumb to temptation is product design. Whether it's the apps you're using, technology devices you hold in your hand right now, video games that you play, or the services that you use, here are six things that the engineers who designed them do intentionally so that you stay hooked and use them for as long as possible, as highlighted in the book Irresistible by Adam Altler. First of all is variable rewards. If you go on Instagram or YouTube, where we are now, not everything is rewarding. No, maybe one post in 15 is rewarding, which dopamine loves. If everything's rewarding, then it becomes boring very quickly. But if you have anticipation of this could potentially be rewarding, then it's not. And then the next thing is reward prediction error. Dopamine loves that. The second way that engineers design their things so that we stay hooked is anticipation. Highlight reels, which show what might be coming. Refresh your feed or cliffhangers. The third way is simplicity. Technology is incredibly easy to use. If it's easy, we will do it and be on it. The fourth is casino feedback. Things are flashy. Sounds ping. Notifications bombard us. The fifth is frictionless access. Technology is always there. It's a forever companion. So whenever we feel unpleasant emotions, we can instantly rely on it to soothe us. And the sixth and most interesting, in my opinion, is pseudo connection. When we are engaging in technology in order to solve a social or meet a social need, we are duping ourselves because we engage in a high social activity online. We're texting loads of people, we're calling loads of people, we're sending loads of messages and we're playing games with them or whatever. What we don't realize is that actually results in low social nourishment, because no matter how many hours throughout the day you speak to people online, it will never be the same as speaking to someone face to face. So you feel lonelier, which means your social needs are higher, meaning you then use that thing which gave you that social, high social activity, and then the loop just repeats. To finalize this section, mapping this to the three stages of addiction, you use this technology more, which means your dopamine receptors are dulled and they are less sensitive. Technology becomes more of a relief, and then your cravings fire much faster, dulling your receptors even more. You need more stimulation, and we just go around in the loop again until we all throw up. The fifth and final reason we succumb to temptation is the final reason as to why we give in to temptation is because we always have. In the ancient world, the main temptations people faced were gluttony and excess. The Roman philosophers Cicero and Seneca warned people of engaging in fine feasts, drinking lots of wine, and succumbing to the temptation of lust for fear that it would corrupt the soul. It is not the man who has too little, but the man who craves more that is poor, Seneca warned the Romans. In the Enlightenment and Industrial Age, new temptations were brought to the forefront of society. Food and sex were no longer the temptations, but status and material excess were. Men have become the tools of their tools, Thoreau warned people. Nowadays, since the 2000s up until now, the temptations we face have a digital face. Instant relief and self-soothing, the phone buzz, binge, like, and escape. The urge to check Twitter or refresh Reddit becomes a nervous twitch which shatters uninterrupted time into shards too small to support the presence necessary to live an intentional life, in the words of Cal Newport. So the bottom line here is we've always faced temptation. It's just the tools that we've invented have shaped how those temptations manifest. The Romans had wine. Victorian England had wealth. And nowadays, in the digital age, we have Wi-Fi. So every human being has faced temptation. Every human being, as well as you, is facing temptation right now. You are not alone in your struggle. Hopefully that awakens you to the common humanity that we all share. As the saying goes from that saint whose name eludes me, you will face temptation, or expect temptation, until your last breath. So that is the final reason. Now, you want to get into the practical stuff right now. And we're going to. We're going to cover exactly how to reverse all of the reasons so that we can realize all of the solutions for falling into temptation that we need to. But before we do so, there is one bonus reason as to why we succumb to temptation, but this bonus reason only applies to certain individuals. So if you've had enough of all of the reasons and you just want to get into the practical stuff, skip the next 5 minutes and I'll see you in section number 3. But if what I've just said has piqued your curiosity, then here is the final bigger picture thing we are going to cover in this section. And it begins with the realization that your personality doesn't really rely on who you are. It's shaped based on where you are. Seeing as this is a bonus point, I thought we would take a quick break from the whiteboard and explain it here. By the way, if the camera quality is a bit grainy, it's because I got it on selfie mode. The other mode just makes the lighting in the room go a bit weird. But anyway, who does this bonus reason apply to? Well, if you come from or live in a poverty-stricken area, or you work with children or adults who come from poverty-stricken areas, then what I'm about to explain will help you understand why being impulsive in such an environment makes complete sense. The bottom line, as we've explored a few times throughout this video, if opportunities in front of you could be here today and gone tomorrow, then it makes sense for you to be impulsive and act on them now so as to seize the opportunity. Because if you wait, then there's no guarantee that you're going to get this opportunity tomorrow. And then that impulsivity that is created within you due to the environment of scarcity in which you live then becomes an identity of you being an impulsive person. And by the way, by opportunities we mean opportunities for jobs, money, food, resources, shelter, shelter and safety. So what is the why behind this? What explains this? Well, a brilliant article, another one I read in researching for this video, is titled "Personality is not only about who, but also where you are." And it blew my mind. And it's from the evolutionary anthropologist Dorsa Amir. And the big picture she paints in her article is the criticisms of the landmark marshmallow experiment done in the 70s. Just to re-jog your memory, in that experiment, researchers got children to sit down in front of a marshmallow. And they said, you can eat this marshmallow now, but if you wait 10 to 20 minutes, you'll get a second one. The results show that the children who exercised patience to wait for a second marshmallow did better later on in life, academically, professionally, and they were more resilient to stress. But in 2010, another researcher called Joseph Henrich and his colleagues highlighted the bias of not only this study, but most research in psychology. They showed that 96% of all participants who participate in psychological research come from weird societies, Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. In other words, societies where you can freely walk into a supermarket, food and resources aren't scarce, and you have access to education. Now, why is this a problem? Well, for two reasons. First reason, weird societies only take up 12% of the world's population. So using people who come from these societies to represent the average human being doesn't work because they don't represent the average human being. And the final reason why this is problematic is because weird societies are a modern invention. They don't represent the environment in which we evolved in as human beings, environments of scarcity. Now, just before we move on here into Dorsa's research, bit of bad news. The researchers who came up with the weird acronym have been a bit vague. They didn't give a definitive list as to these countries are weird, these countries aren't. But we can have a bit of an understanding as to which ones are and aren't. They've given some examples of weird societies can be those found in America, Canada, some countries of Europe. Non-weird societies can be some of those found in places in Latin America, Asia, and parts of Africa. So, after digesting all of these research findings, Dorsa then wanted to ask a very particular question, which was, well, if you want to research the relationship between personality and environment without being biased, what do you do? The answer? Go straight to childhood and spread your research across non-weird societies as well. So this is exactly what her and her team did. They did a version of the marshmallow experiment. And they did so in four different countries. They went to Argentina, the USA, India, three countries considered weird. Sorry, that's my light bouncing about. But they also went to a final community. They visited the Shuar people in Amazonian Ecuador. Now, why would they visit this latter community? Well, it's because the Shuar people live in a non-weird society. They live off-grid, in the rainforest. They fish and hunt for their food, and they grow their own crops. They don't have supermarkets readily available for them to go in, or schools, for example. In fact, in order to reach the Shuar community, Dorsa and her team had to travel up a long, winding river in the Amazon called the Morona River. So what they actually did in their experiments in these four different societies is a version of the marshmallow experiment, but slightly different. They offered children aged 4 to 18 a choice between one candy today or an increasing number of candies if they were willing to wait a day. The incentive was, if you could muster up the patience, you'd be candy rich the next day. For uncertainty, they got to choose between a safe bag that always paid out one candy or a risky bag that gave them only a 1 in 6 chance of more candy. The results? Well, maybe you've guessed this already, but children, most of them, in America, India and Argentina, exercised patience to wait for more candy tomorrow. They took the risk, but most of the Shuar kids did the exact opposite. They were much more risk-averse and impatient. They took the candies now while they had the chance to do so. So fascinated by these research findings, Dorsa and her team, 1 year later, did a follow-up study, and they revisited the Shuar community, but they did the experiment again on Shuar communities who live closer to the city, an industrialized society. And what they found is that the Shuar kids who live closer to the city were more patient, and they were more likely to wait a day for the potential of receiving more candies. So, to cut through the noise and to explain the why behind this, Dorsa says, in weird societies with more resources, remember that the R in weird stands for rich, kids might feel that they can better afford strategies such as patience and risk seeking. If they get unlucky and pull out a green marble and didn't win any candy, that's okay, it didn't cost them that much. But for Shuar kids in the rainforest with less resources, the loss of that candy is a much bigger deal. They'd rather avoid the risk. Over time, these successful strategies can stabilize and become recurrent strategies for interacting with our world. So, for instance, in an environment where the costs of waiting are high, people might be consistently impatient. So, now zooming back into the relevance this has to your life and to reiterate the point we began with as we opened this segment, look around you. In the society, in the community in which you live, if you live in a society of poverty, where resources are scarce, then it makes sense for you to be impulsive. So too, if you work with children or adults who come from poverty-stricken areas and you notice that in their behaviour they're being impulsive, then this perspective allows you the opportunity to give those people a dose of compassion and understand that their impulsivity can likely be explained not due to a character flaw on their end, but simply as a consequence of the environment of scarcity in which they live. So I'm offering this perspective, one, because I thought it was quite cool, and mainly as to offer you self-compassion if you live in poverty, and compassion to other people you work with if they come from poverty. But now moving on, let's close this section. Let's get back to the whiteboard and let's get into the solutions we need to cover to really resist succumbing to temptation and impulsivity. But before we do so, let's quickly take a 30-second summary of everything we covered in the five reasons. Our brain is wired to seek rather than to satisfy, meaning neuroadaptation escalates that seeking, emotions and cues automate it, design supercharges it, but all of this is just an old story with new weapons. Finally. Well, not finally. Now, let's get into how to resist temptation. Oh, by the way, postman came. New colours. New places. Ooh, let's put them down here. Yeah. Okay, before we get into the five solutions, whoa, it is grey outside. Yeah, the light changes throughout the video because the weather in the UK is bipolar. Before we get into the five practical solutions to beating temptation, let's quickly get clear on what success means for us here. Success does not mean eliminating every impulse you have. No, success for us means sharpening your psychological tools so you can control your impulses instead of them ruining your life. So let's get into it. There's going to be about 5 to 10 different tools that we're going to cover. Some will speak more to you, so pay more attention to them. Why 5 to 10? Why so many? Because the more tools you have in your psychological tool belt, the better your chances are of flourishing and spiraling upwards. So, tool number one. Okay, point number one, and this is one of my favourite tools. Specifically, what we're referencing here is point number one from the last section, which was the chase, not the hit. Problem recap, our brain is addicted to maybe. Dopamine fires in anticipation of a reward, not when you satisfy it, which is why you can think of engaging in a temptation, your body gets ready for action and you want to act on it. So the solution here is, first of all, you need to remember that your urges aren't the problem. Your reaction to them is. And then second of all, you need to surf those urges instead of suppressing them. Why? Oh, and by the way, if you haven't noticed already, we're going to be using the words of urge, craving, impulse, temptation interchangeably to mean the same thing. Why is it important that you surf your urges? Well, it's because they are waves. They rise, they peak, and then they fall. All you need to do is ride them to shore by staying in the gap between thought, you think about the possibility of engaging in this temptation and your body gets ready for action, and you actually acting on it. There is a space where you can stay free from having to give in. How do you do so? Well, you let the impulse rain on you. First of all, you recognize the impulse. Ah, the craving is here. Then you allow it. You let it exist, judgment free. You don't try and evaluate it by saying, oh, I shouldn't be having this temptation. This is so bad. No, just allow it to exist. Then you investigate specifically what's happening in your body and where. And then you note, you label those sensations, pardon me, with words such as, I notice my chest is tight. There's a buzzing sensation in my stomach. You let it rain on you. And you reframe the existence of this craving from seeing it as an emergency to simply seeing it as energy moving through your body. That's all you need to do. You need to let it pass through you without acting on it. I know that is easy to say. So although this is my favorite, one of my favorite tools, let's pick apart the weaknesses of it so we can counteract them. Well, if we look at let the impulse rain on you, what I would suggest specifically is write this acronym down on a flashcard and keep it visible. Because one of the weaknesses of the rain technique is it is dependent on you remembering to let the impulse rain on you and go through these four steps whenever the impulse arises. Now, that's going to be a little bit tricky because when the impulse arises, it's going to be really, really strong and you're likely not going to have a lot of cognitive space to remember something like this. So write it down on a flashcard so that you can remember to do it in moments of temptation. Keep that flashcard visible. Now, the last thing I would like to suggest here is, in order to counteract the randomness of you relying on yourself to remember this acronym when temptation arises, depending on what temptation you're struggling most with right now, I suggest getting it, specifically inviting temptation to arise within you, and then going through these four steps. What might this look like? Well, if your temptation that you're struggling with right now is eating junk food, buy a chocolate bar, put it in front of you, and simply look at it. And when you look at it, your brain will think, well, in this scenario, we usually eat this chocolate bar, so it's going to make you feel tempted to eat it. Sit there and set a timer for 10 minutes and simply go through these four steps and train yourself to do it. If your temptation at the moment is watching pornography, don't open up an adult video, don't do that. Sit there and imagine a scene from a video you've seen before that is likely going to get you very aroused, and then go through these four steps. If your temptation is scrolling, put your phone in front of you, set a timer for 10 minutes, go through these four steps. Why is doing this important? Well, it's because it's training you ahead of time to practice this skill. So hopefully the next time you don't, or you're caught, you know, off guard by this temptation, your brain can remember, oh, last time we faced this, this is what we did. We let the impulse rain on us. It's not an emergency, it's just energy moving through. Now, the last reason why letting the impulse rain on you is important is because it stops the automatic loop of your survival brain acting on the temptation now in a fight or flight mode. It encourages your prefrontal cortex to engage its pause and plan system, where it thinks, oh, impulse, this part of our brain wants us to do this, hold on, let's think about this. And within that space of thinking, what happens? The urge rises, it gets really intense, but if you stay there long enough, it will decrease. What we're talking about here is essentially mindfulness. And if you have a mindfulness practice, great. If you don't, maybe you would just like to practice mindfulness for one minute or 5 minutes each day. There's plenty of apps out there that you can use. Within this context, you know, you might practice mindfulness for spiritual reasons, but you can now start practicing it to increase your chances of resisting the temptation the next time it arises. Because if your temptations are like you being in a casino, then mindfulness is the exit door. Was there anything else I wanted to mention here? Mindfulness is basically mental weightlifting. Okay, write that down on a flashcard, keep it visible, and surf the urge whenever it arises. Two more tools here related to this, which I use. By the way, I have used the RAIN technique randomly. I think it was about 3 weeks ago, because my biggest temptation that I struggle with is when I'm doing work in the morning, if I'm procrastinating on a project and it's really hard, like a video like this, then I just want to distract myself by going on Twitter or Reddit or whatever. A few weeks ago, I was sat there, I had the urge to distract myself from the project I was working on, and I remembered the acronym, I let it happen. Within 3 minutes, the impulse just went and I got back to what I was doing. Two more tools. The last two tools here are based upon the idea that when the wave of the impulse hits, have a plan in place. Two plans that you can instill: roadblocks, time limits on the apps you're using, remove the triggers that usually tempt you, avoid the people or places that pull you into distraction. Speaking of distraction, this is the last way to have a plan. This is my second favorite tool of this whole segment. Distractions are things you can do in face of an urge that require your full attention, such as reading, writing, speaking to a friend, playing with a pet, going out on a walk, exercise. And the point here is, when the impulse arises and you engage in a distraction, you don't necessarily need to enjoy the distraction that is taking your attention away from the urge. No, you just need to get through the urge so that its intensity can decrease. And what you're doing here is you're training your brain to prioritize long-term peace instead of short-term comfort. I love this tool because it works for me. Going back to my example of when I face temptation the most, which is in the morning and I'm doing deep work and I get distracted because I'm overwhelmed by the project I'm working on, to demonstrate what I do, I have a list of 7 questions I write down or I answer each night before I go to bed, which maps out the following morning's deep work. And one of the questions is, if I get stuck mid-session, what's my next move? And that answer is always go for a walk and then make a cup of tea. Because if I sit there most of the time and the urge to distract myself by scrolling is really intense, there's no amount of cognitive tricks that I can play which will make that urge to go. But if I go out for a walk for 5 to 10 minutes and my attention is fully away from that context, then the urge just naturally dissipates. Walking is my savior when I am experiencing an urge, because it gets all of my attention. Question: what could your distraction be in moments of temptation? If you're a young man and you've been on something like NoFap, for example, then you will have heard the advice that cold showers, when you're experiencing sexual urges, is king. Makes total sense. Because there's nothing that is going to get your full attention more than blasting freezing cold water on yourself. That explains this segment. Okay, the second solution, based upon the second reason we fall into temptation, is... this is from the second reason, neuroadaptation, which problem recap: the more highs you chase, the more numb your brain becomes, which is why you need more stimulation to feel the same level of reward. It's not that your willpower has disappeared, it's just that your dopamine receptors have become dull and less sensitive. So the solution here is, you don't need to punish yourself, you just need more space from this thing so that your dopamine receptors can resensitize. How can you do so? Well, with an abstinence window. Some people call it dopamine detox, we'll just call it an abstinence window. Take some time, anywhere between a week and a month, away from doing this thing completely. Why? Well, it's because if you've constantly done this thing and your brain is now desensitized to it, in order to become sensitized or resensitized to life, you'll need to get out of this dopamine deficit state you're in which is where your dopamine levels have gone below baseline. You feel mentally lethargic. You don't have a lot of energy. Normal things you found fun are no longer fun. You can recover within about 1 to 3 days. You just need to give your brain and body space to do its thing and get itself back up to baseline. But if you went further and really abstained for a week, 3 weeks, or even a month or 90 days, then you would experience a complete resensitization and you start to feel that zest for life again. You go out into the woods and you start looking at plants and think, oh my God, what? This is amazing. Why does that happen? It's not necessarily because you have more dopamine in the brain. It's just what we're banging on about here. Your dopamine receptors have become more open to receiving that dopamine, which is why life feels great again. Just an interesting thing here. When I was 18, I was living in Poland in a hostel, and I met a guy there called Martin, who was from Norway, and he was a seasoned traveller. He had been travelling for years by himself. He was about 29 in his late 20s, and each month, every single month without fail, he would pick one thing to abstain from. Sometimes it would be sex, coffee, other substances, music, for example, just as these interesting abstinence experiments while he was traveling. And I spoke to him about it, and he said it always served him well because it gave himself the self-esteem and self-confidence to prove to himself, oh, I'm not hooked on this thing. I can take some distance from it. But that is easier said than done. So here is another tool that is going to help you take this abstinence. Reconnect on why giving in hurts. Remember when we went through this section and we covered the work from that researcher who demonstrated that the more you practice giving in to a temptation and the more you practice dishonesty, the less reactive your emotions are. And the reason why that is dangerous is because your emotions regulate your behavior. The more numb your emotional response in the face of you giving into a temptation, the more likely you're going to be to give into that temptation because your emotions aren't screaming at you saying, don't do this. So if you reconnect on why giving into this temptation hurts, you're putting your emotions in the exact place they need to be to regulate your behavior. Now, when we covered the bottom line of this video, we suggested a technique called mental multiplication, whereby you don't just consider the effects of giving into this temptation once, because if you do, then you'll always be able to excuse it. Hence why most people who smoke only buy one packet of cigarettes at a time. However, if you mentally multiply your actions and consider in depth the consequences of giving into this temptation, not just once, but every single day for the next 90 days, year, 2 years, 3 years, then you will scare yourself from doing this. That is another reason why mental multiplication works. Yeah, the guilt, the regret, the time you'll never get back, feel that fully because emotion is a regulator. Okay. And once you start doing this, you then want to outline some specific things in your mental multiplication. If you would like to do some journaling, which takes not too long, only about 5 to 10 minutes about mental multiplication, then here are 3 things that will guide you in doing so. First of all, pick the one behavior which is causing a problem for you at the moment. Then ask yourself, by reflecting on the positives, how would my life change if this habit wasn't in control? Write your answer. What would improve in terms of my energy, relationships, and productivity? To give you an example, let's say the temptation you want to beat is constantly scrolling on Instagram or anything else on your phone. If you gave up this habit, then the positives you could experience are more time with your friends and family, less isolation and less feelings of anxiety, better sleep, rest, better productivity. You want to list your positives so that when you read them, you feel a buzz of excitement in your stomach. Then you list the consequences, the direct opposites of these things. Be honest with yourself. Really think in gruesome graphic detail what is giving in to this temptation really costing you. Because every urge has a receipt. Read it. For example, in this scenario of scrolling, What this is costing you is loneliness, anxiety, tired mornings, falling behind, the guilt of spending another evening scrolling it into oblivion. These are just quick examples for the sake of brevity on the board, but when you're writing this, spend 5 to 10 minutes really getting as graphic as possible so that when you read the list of consequences, you feel horrible. You read it and you feel scared into not wanting to do them, because when you read the consequences, they're just so graphic, it's unreal. And then the last thing you want to do is take these two things and, well, specifically take the consequences and compare them against your goals. Because whether you've actually written them down or not, or you're the type of person who likes to write out your goals, you have things in your life in which you're striving towards. So write them down. Maybe write a list of 1 to 3 of your main goals at the moment. Then next to those goals in a column like this, so you have your goals on the left-hand side, and then in the right-hand side, write down how this temptation is directly sabotaging this goal. Just get clear on it. And then you ask yourself, now you're clear on how the temptation is sabotaging your goal and you've got the goal on the left-hand side, which one are you willing to give up? Do you want to give up the goal? Or do you want to give up the temptation that is sabotaging it? Genuinely ask yourself that question, because you might find that there's part of you that wants to continue with this temptation. But I want you to connect with the part of you that wants you to achieve your goals and give up anything that is sabotaging it. Now, the point here is your life will improve when the long-term cost of doing a habit outweighs the short-term relief it gives you. We got quite serious there. But it's worth me being serious to communicate the importance of listing the consequences of this thing, because until you get razor sharp and crystal clear on what this thing is costing you, you'll continue to do it. Now, the last solution I want to mention in this segment before we close it is pleasure without impulses. Now, the key takeaway I want you to have here is we're not talking about removing pleasure. We're simply talking about redefining it. And this redefinition can be arrived at by differentiating between two words that we use a lot but don't really understand the difference between. Now, I understood the difference between excitement and joy when I read the brilliant book, The Craving Mind, and it blew my mind, this difference. You see, excitement is the whisper of dopamine. It leaves you, engaging in something very exciting leaves you feeling restless, and it always leaves you wanting more. Engaging in an exciting activity is a short-term fix, and it leaves you feeling drained. Joy, however, is much longer lasting. It leaves you feeling grounded. It leaves you with the sense of enough, and it makes you feel replenished after you engage in this joyful activity. So, two tools to finalize this section with are replace excitement for joy. Remember, excitement is a short-term thrill. It's an activity which provides you with pleasure first, pain later. Joy might even provide you with slight pain first, but then it will settle you into a feeling of pleasure, which is much longer lasting later. For example, exciting behaviours could be scrolling, eating junk food, all of the temptations we've mentioned so far. Anything that leaves you feeling drained after. Joyful activities could be doing the workout that you love, doing that exercise that you love, going to the gym, reading a book, making something creative, speaking to a friend. Remember, activities which require a little bit of effort initially, but then result in longer lasting pleasure after. So do your best to replace excitement for joy. I mean, you might want to genuinely replace those activities, but I have found in my experience, just understanding the difference between these two things, whenever I'm about to do something, I ask myself, is this a joyful activity? Am I going to feel replenished after, or am I going to feel drained after? And I usually try and prioritize the joyful activities. Now, the last tool is to understand the difference between cookies and broccoli. You see, most of the time when we try to motivate ourselves, we do so just by trying to highlight why cookies are bad. And I know we did that in the last section, and we did it because it's important to do. It's just important not to stop there. What you also want to do is highlight the positives as to why eating broccoli is good. And the way you can do this is link the temptation you're trying to resist to what you love most. So you're not just saying this temptation is bad and trying to scare yourself all the time. No, you need to scare yourself, but you also need something positive to pursue. What this might sound like is, if you're dealing with the temptation of lust, I love feeling confident, present, and clean. That's the positives of what broccoli gives you. If I PMO, I lose that. You see how it's intertwined with a positive? Oh, I love the feeling of confidence, being present and clean. But if I PMO, I will mess all this up. So you're being pushed, but you're also being pulled as well. Another example, final one. I love feeling energized and I love when my skin is clear and vibrant. Eating junk food robs this from me. Positive, but you're also being pushed by something negative as well. That is the last thing there. Bollocks. Third solution, three more. The third reason we covered as to why we give into temptation is due to emotional vulnerability and conditioning. Problem recap. When we are stressed, tired, our brain is frazzled, or we feel lonely and guilty, our willpower plummets. Because our brain and nervous system aren't prioritizing discipline, they want relief. Because they're in a state of dysregulation and they want to move to regulation. So the solution here is, before you resist any temptation, you need to regulate your nervous system. And here are, well, why would doing that be important? It's because if your body's in fight or flight mode, because it's dysregulated, it can't pause and plan. In other words, access willpower. So here are five quick tools we're going to cover which will help you regulate your nervous system, the first of which is one of my favourites when it comes to mentioning this topic. Increase your heart rate variability. Your heart rate variability is simply the space between your heartbeats. This is a term I learned from the book I read, one of the books I read researching for this topic, The Willpower Instinct. Why is increasing your heart rate variability important? Well, it's because people with higher HRV, heart rate variability, can access more willpower and they are better at delaying gratification. The logic behind this, or the science behind this, is because when your brain isn't in a rush, it can pause and plan. And the higher the variability between your heartbeats, the more adaptable your body and brain are to stress. So, there are many things you can do to increase your HRV, but the main one I'm going to suggest is turn to your breath. Most people breathe at 12 breaths per minute. In order to regulate your nervous system and increase your heart rate variability, breathe between 4 and 6 breaths per minute. What that might sound like is inhaling for 4 seconds, exhaling for 6 seconds. So, why would you do a longer exhale? It's because the longer your exhale longer to send the message to your brain and body that you are calming down. Think about it. When you're anxious, what do? You go, you inhale quicker than you exhale. So to calm yourself down, exhale longer than you inhale. I'm going to put a link in the description or in the pinned comment to the breath work that I use. This a little 20-minute breath work on Spotify from a woman called Shiva Rasa. It's a bit spiritual and woo-woo, but I really like it. It's completely for free. I don't actually know her. I don't know even if she exists or she's an AI, but I'll put that link in the description. When you're in a state of dysregulation, you can try and convince yourself of all of these different things, but if your physiology is dysregulated, the easiest way to get back on track is with your breath. The mind is the master over the body, but the breath is the master over the mind. And also, when you flood your brain with oxygen, it all goes to your most of it goes to your prefrontal cortex, meaning it's back online and you can pause and plan. The second tool is to note the things you already know already, but within this fresh context of HRV. all of the things that negatively affect your HRV are bad sleep, drama in your life. Even an argument can decrease your heart rate variability. Lack of movement and eating junk food, which is spiking your cortisol levels and keeping you alert and awake in times when you should be in a state of regulation and down regulation. For example, drinking caffeine after 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So just simply reverse all of these. Make sure that your sleep is as optimized as possible. Follow the 3-2-1 rule. You know, don't eat 3 hours before bed. Don't drink 2 hours before bed. Turn technology and screens off 1 hour before bed. Aim to get about 8 hours of sleep a night. Be ruthless. Cut people out of your life who are providing you with drama and making you argue and pulling you into just petty squabbles. Make sure you move for minimum 5 minutes a day, because even a 5 minute walk can increase your willpower. Why? Because exercise and movement gets your prefrontal cortex back online. Have you ever done a workout, come home, and after you just feel as if you just want to do loads of positive productive stuff? Yeah, it's because you're now pausing and planning. Exercise increases your heart rate variability. The third tool I want to mention here, slightly zooming out of this context, is map the game. You can't navigate a map you don't know you're on. So in order to get clear on the psychological patterns which spiral you down into decreasing your heart rate variability, answer these questions, if you would like to, in an introspection session or journaling session by yourself. They will help you get clear on what is causing you to spiral downwards and decrease your heart rate variability. Okay, tool number four is replace relief with soothing. You know how we said in the problem recap, your brain and nervous system don't prioritize discipline when dysregulated, they prioritize relief. Yeah, that's not a... The reason why that's tricky is because when you're in a state of dysregulation, you're not pausing and planning, which means you're going to be more impulsive. And it just so happens that the impulsive activities we have access to are exciting ones. You know, they leave us feeling drained. So even though your brain and nervous system aren't trying to sabotage your behavior, they're just trying to get a little bit of relief from this uncomfortable state of dysregulation, they don't realize that doing these activities aren't going to provide you with a sense of restoration. They're only going to drain you more. So replace relief with soothing. What do we mean by this? Well, I've got a quick note here. According to the American Psychological Association, the best ways to relieve stress are exercising, playing a sport, praying, reading, listening to music, getting a massage, meditating or doing yoga, spending time outdoors or spending time with friends and family. These methods actually boost the happy chemicals in your brain and diminish the stress response. I fall victim to this all the time. I say, oh, I need a rest, and then I spend the day scrolling, and then I feel worse for the next 3 days. We have to get really clear on what soothing means for us. Relief isn't soothing. If you want a book to read on this, I recommend this one, Soothe, by Nahid de Belgione. It's a brilliant book. It will teach you everything you need to about how to regulate your nervous system, which is what we're briefly touching on here. Oh yeah, the worst ways to relieve stress is by doing something that promises a reward but doesn't deliver. That's pretty much what I was just saying. And the final tool is to forgive fast. Remember we covered a loop which we kind of laughed at, which is you relapse into this bad habit. You feel guilty. That guilt is an unpleasant emotion, so then you want to relapse and relieve yourself from that guilt even more. You feel guilty, relapse, guilt, relapse. How do we break that cycle? You forgive yourself fast. If you relapse after you've spent a time being abstinent from this thing, understand that if you relapse, that doesn't set you back to 0%. It just sets you back to 90%, 80%. And your only task is to forgive yourself so you can continue walking the path. And you might want to aid your process of forgiving yourself by, first of all, accepting that you've relapsed, simply with an acknowledgement. Yeah, okay, I've relapsed. And instead of focusing on all of the criticism you want to throw at yourself, instead, take an instructional lesson from this relapse. What is one thing you can realize from this spiral that will aid you in not spiraling down into it the next time. Just learn one thing. Forgive yourself fast.
Because guilt feeds the next indulgence. Compassion resets your nervous system. Forgive the relapse faster than the relapse happened.
They were a lot of tools. Anything else? Let's move on.
I'm laughing because 3 weeks ago I started recording this video and it was going to be about 20-30 minutes, and then I watched it back and I thought, do you know what? If I'm going to cover a topic, why not just research loads about it and then finally burn the topic so I don't have to revisit it? So if you're still watching up until this point, I appreciate you. The second to last reason as to why we give in to temptation is due to product design. Problem recap: modern temptations are frictionless and highly rewarding. Solution: make bad hard and good easy by focusing on structure, not strength. Three tools that will help you do this. One, add friction. Delete apps. Remove the temptation from your environment. Use timers if you're going to be using technology and your temptation you're dealing with is scrolling. And last thing I wanted to mention here before we move on, we briefly touched upon it in the last section, but I wanted to reiterate the point. Really take stock of the social connections in your life, because if you're bonding with other people due to this temptation that you all give into, then you're just going to continue to do it. When I was reading the Willpower Instinct, there was a study that showed if your friend becomes obese, you're 170% more likely to become obese yourself, no matter how sure of yourself you are. Now, of course, that doesn't apply to everyone, but it was an average in the study. Just prioritize your long-term sanity and you gaining control over this temptation rather than maintaining social connections for fear of being assertive and saying, no, I don't want to be around you anymore because you're engaging in activities that don't align with my values. Prioritize yourself in this case. Respectfully. Tool number two is add flow. Schedule high reward behaviors. Similar to some points we've mentioned, but I wanted to mention this because it is my third favorite tool of this whole video. Build a routine so that you're so distracted by highly rewarding behaviors, you don't have time to be tempted. When I was 18 and I started getting into the NoFap community on Reddit, there was a post I saw where this young man asked his granddad randomly told him, I don't know how the conversation went, but his granddad gave him some advice on how to stop masturbating and PMOing. And he told his grandson, keep yourself busy. And it sounds cliche, but there is such wisdom in that piece of advice. Give yourself the present and the gift to yourself of just being distracted by doing things that you love. Schedule them in. You know, I'm going to upload a video soon about routine because I've had some big realizations as to why routine doesn't work for most of us, because it doesn't synergize. You need something called rhythmic routine, which is what I've been following over the last 2 weeks, and I give you my word, it has been changing my life. So I'll explain a bit more in that video, but make a schedule. Keep yourself busy. Then number three, use pre-commitments. Make a plan, like I do. You know, you might want to use a similar example. Each night, I make sure that I map out what I'm doing tomorrow in the morning when I have prime willpower hours, so that as soon as I wake up, I don't default to the easiest option, which is the last thing I'll mention on these last two points. Why do we have the saying of the devil makes use of idle hands? It's because if you're bored and you don't have anything to do, then you're going to default to the easiest, most depleting and exciting activity. So schedule highly rewarding behaviors. Make bad hard and good easy. Last part. Almost finished the video. Almost done. The final reason why we cave is due to the historical pattern. Problem recap: temptation isn't new, it's human. The solution? Transcend yourself.
Whether it was the ancients in Rome or the philosophers in medieval Britain, most of them could be sat at a table and agree on one thing. It is important for us human beings to strive for that which is bigger than ourselves. So, realize that your abstinence now is for something bigger. Whether it's the bigger picture of you helping your future self, that version of you 5 minutes, 5 months, 5 years into the future, who you will meet and who will be grateful or regretful for your current actions, do it for them and realize that each time you restrain, you're allowing them to receive the reward. If you're in a relationship or you have people who rely on you in your life, imagine with deep visual clarity the joy and the gratitude they will express or could express when you tell them that you're no longer being pulled by this temptation anymore. If you're a young man trying to defeat lust and you're in a relationship or you want to be in a relationship, imagine the glee on your girlfriend's face when you tell her you've been 90 days clean, or she just notices your presence and your abundance of confidence and energy that you can now bring into the relationship. Imagine the joy of your family when you're no longer being pulled into the slippery slope of depletion by all of your junk food temptations, and instead you're feeling vibrant and you're feeling the vitality to actually be energetic and do things with them and say yes to opportunities and put more water, or water the plant of your connections so that they grow. Increase the responsibility in your life so you have people who expect things from you, and you know that if you engage in this temptation, then it will mess everything up. Whether this bigger picture is your job and the purpose that you want to serve in the world, keep it close so that you know exactly what you're giving up and what you are sabotaging when you engage in this temptation. You know, for the Romans, it was contribute to the betterment of Rome. In the Romantic era, it was worship the spirit of love and the spirit of creation. Do it for something bigger. Do it for something bigger. Those are all the solutions I want to leave you with. Before we end this video, there's only one more thing I would like to mention, which is a surprising one. Because it's not all doom and gloom when it comes to giving in to your impulses. Sometimes there are big upsides to being impulsive. Here's what I mean. Now, to finalise this video, there is only one more researcher I'm going to briefly introduce you to, Janan Mostajabi. She researches personality, and what she has found is that for those of us who act more impulsively than others, we do so because it's part of our personality. This personality trait of acting impulsively is termed disinhibition. And it's the opposite of conscientiousness. Conscientiousness is your ability to be persistent in the face of pursuing a goal. The disinhibited act on a whim. They speak before they think, they act before they think. They are the true embodiments of the Nike slogan, just do it. Now, whether this sounds as if it's describing yourself or someone else you know quite well in your life, I think we all know someone like this, then here are the upsides of being disinhibited. These people are electrifying. I know many people like this in my life, and being around them is a breath of fresh air. Why? Because they call you randomly to go clubbing on a Tuesday night. They encourage you to follow your heart instead of being so logical all of the time. They make quick decisions, but most importantly, they encourage all of us to do that which we struggle with the most, which is to live in the moment and not worry much about the future. But the only downsides to it are, it's a personality trait, so you can't really change it unless you put in a ton of emotional work and went to therapy for a very, very long time, if you score high on disinhibition. So the key isn't to change it, is simply to accept it in yourself and other people by not putting unrealistic expectations onto yourself or those in your life who score high on disinhibition. Because think about it this way. Scoring high in disinhibition doesn't mean you are morally wrong. In the same way as if someone close to you had a cold or came down with the flu, you wouldn't think they were morally wrong or a bad person either. No, so too it goes with disinhibition. So embrace it, accept it, and understand that it is the part of you which is responsible for you feeling creative and feeling that zest for life. But gone too far, of course, it can spiral into unproductive patterns. So four things you might want to bear in mind if you think you score high on disinhibition is to name it, then aim it. Use this impulsivity and this energy for the beginnings of things, you know. Use it to start new projects with forward momentum or leap into a new conversation. Build rails for it, you know. Add structure around it. You might want to say, I can only do this impulsive behavior for this amount of time. So you're balancing your energy to be impulsive with guardrails around it, which we've covered some of these things throughout this video. Plan tiny indulgences as well, you know, because it's better to plan lapses of impulsivity than fall for big explosions. And finally, reframe your identity. You know, say, I'm not broken. I'm a high spark. I choose where this burns. One friend who is close to me comes to mind. She's called Naz, and she is a hippie, essentially. And socializing with her, doing things with her is, you never really know what to expect because it's very, oh, let's do this. Oh, let's go to this. Oh, let's go here, there, and everywhere. And it's brilliant. I just know that if I'm organizing to do something with her, I can never expect her to be on time. And when I first met her about 3 years ago, I score higher in conscientiousness than disinhibition, although I have my moments. So sometimes I would organise to meet her and she would be 30 minutes late or she would change the time. And at the beginning of that friendship, I would get really annoyed and just think, oh, you're not respecting my time and everything. But then over time, I started to realise, oh, this is an unrealistic expectation to put on her, because she's quite an impulsive person and she doesn't have the best organisational skills. So it was a key moment in my friendship with her because I stopped resisting her personality and actually started to embrace it, if that makes sense. I've had that experience with a few other people as well. So impulsivity, the bottom line here is impulsivity plus intention equals vitality. So, in summary, oh, by the way, I'll put a link to Janan, or what was her name, the researcher's article in the description. In summary, your urges, impulses, cravings, and temptations are not commands. They are simply waves that rise, peak, and fall. So all you need to do is see them as energy passing through, and sit in that space between thought and action by surfing the urge and riding it to shore. Understand the wiring, build the pauses, design your environment, and aim your energy at what matters. Just because you experience temptation doesn't mean you are broken. It means you're a human being. If you would like to go to therapy, based on some of the problems we've spoken about in this video, then you might like to seek a therapist who is specialised in one of the four disciplines. DBT, Dialectical Behavioural Therapy, this will help you with emotional regulation. CBT, Cognitive Behavioural Therapy, this will help you with cue mapping and understanding your behavioural algorithms and building new ones. ACT, Acceptance and Commitment Therapy, this will help you rebuild a more accepting attitude towards yourself so you can forgive your relapses faster. And MBCT, Mindfulness-Based Cognitive Therapy, to help you surf the urge. If you've made it this far into the video, I cannot express how much I appreciate your time and attention. If you have made it this far, then comment a trio of emojis down below of a wizard, a fountain, and then pick the third one as your favourite emoji. Stay disciplined, playful, and dangerous. Adios, muchachos y muchachas.